Right, so hi everyone. Thank you very much for being here. I'm going to be presenting two new results related to quantum tasks in relativistic spacetime. So the study of like operational tasks in games has been an important methodology for quantum information and quantum foundations for a long time. So for example, it was by studying what can be achieved by various sorts of non-local boxes that we operationally define non-local boxes that we initially came to the understanding that quantum mechanics, non-local is not the maximally non-local non-signaling theory. There exist boxes known as the PR boxes, which achieve stronger non-local correlations than quantum mechanics, but are still non-signaling. So this operational methodology has achieved success in many areas. However, up until quite recently, most of this type of work was done and implicitly assuming an idealized non-relativistic background. So relativistic constraints really weren't taken into account in these types of studies at all. So more recently, people have begun doing works citing these quantum tasks specifically in a relativistic space-time. And that's useful because, of course, we live in a world which is, in fact, both quantum and relativistic, and so it's of practical importance to understand what tasks can actually be achieved in such a world. This is also of foundational interest because by understanding how quantum information and quantum states behave in a space-time environment, we hope to gain a better understanding of how the two theories relate to each other and perhaps make some progress on the vexed question of how to bring them together. So I'm going to present two results in this field of work. The first is both developed with Professor Adrian Kent of Cambridge. So the first is what we call our quantum paradox of choice. This is based on a generalization of something called the no-summoning theorem. So I'll start by explaining the no-summoning theorem and the generalization of it due to Hayden and May. I'll then present our new generalization, which is summoning with unrestricted calls. I will explain how the paradox arises from this generalization, and then I'll discuss some points, some interpretational points about those results. I'll then present our zero-knowledge proving task, and so I'll motivate that by talking about zero-knowledge proofs in the classical context. I'll then define our quantum generalization of this, which is known as knowledge concealing evidencing of knowledge of a quantum state. It's a bit of a mouthful, I didn't choose the name. Then I will present two new no-go theorems characterizing the possibilities with which one can achieve this task. I'll then present a new proposed protocol, which we believe to be optimal within the constraints set out by the no-go theorems. And then again, I'll discuss some interpretational points. So first off, the no-summoning theorem. So this was, I think, probably the first major result in this field of relativistic quantum tasks. It's again due to Professor Adrian Kent. So the setup envisioned is as follows. We have some agent Alice. Alice is supposed to be cooperating with a network of agents who are spread throughout space-time and who are limited in their communications with each other only by the laws of nature. So we then have a start point at some space-time point at which Alice will be given a quantum system which has been prepared in a state that is unknown to her. We then also have two call points lying in the future light cone of the start point and space-like separated from each other. The idea is that at exactly one of those call points, a call will be made, and then in order to have responded successfully to the task, Alice will be required to return a quantum system in the same state as the one she was initially given at the start point. So the theorem, we then make the following observation. Suppose that on some run of this task, calls are made by accident at both of the call points. Now, it follows from the no-signaling theorem that what happens at one of the call points can't influence what happens at the other call point. So if Alice has a protocol which is guaranteed to succeed on every run of this task when only one call is made, that protocol must necessarily succeed at both call points under these circumstances. So when two calls are made, Alice must return a copy of the state at both of the call points. But that, of course, violates the quantum no-cloning theorem, which says that Alice can't reliably have a mechanism which produces two copies of a given unknown state. So it follows, therefore, from the no-signaling theorem together with the no-cloning theorem that there exists no protocol that Alice can engage in which guarantees a successful response to this task. And so that's the no-summoning theorem. It says that summoning in this particular context is impossible. It's a simple observation, but it depends intrinsically both on the quantum mechanical principles and on relativistic principles, and so it is bringing those two theories together in an interesting way.
I want to back up and think a stunning task is that at Allison, do we ask to provide state at one of two call points?
Yes.
Both.
We have two call points, yeah. A call will be made at one or the other, and Allison is supposed to return it at just one of them. Yeah.
It's the same call and state, it's supposed to be returned at...
Yes, at one or the other.
Right, and this is a quantum state, not a possible description of the quantum. The house doesn't have a possible description.
No, Alice is given a system prepared in that quantum state.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, she then gets to transport her quantum state to whichever call point is appropriate. And,
had she had the power to clone,
yeah,
she would have been given an advance notice of which call point she needs to deliver it to, and then taking it to that call point.
If she could clone, she could make two copies and send one to each call point, and then just return it as needed.
So she learns which call point she has to deliver at earlier time, because in the overlap of the back of the light comes up two call points.
No, she doesn't. That's why she can't do the task.
Oh, I see. So she learns...
She only learns at the call point.
So she has an agent at each call point.
Yeah.
She learns, and the
whole
cloning that we're imagining would be her just setting herself up for success.
Yeah, so if she could clone it, she could send one to each call point, and then she could always respond to either of the calls. But she can't clone, so effectively she has to choose to send it to one call point or the other. She can't have it at both, and therefore she won't. Since she doesn't know in advance where the call will be made, she can't guarantee that she'll be able to respond successfully. Makes sense? Summoning makes sense so far? Okay, so this sort of simple idea was generalized by Hayden and May, who defined a summoning task as follows. So again, we have a start point where Alice is going to be given a quantum system in a state that is unknown to her. We then have a set of call response pairs. The call response pairs can be spread anywhere throughout space-time. The idea is that a call will be made at exactly one of the call points. And if a call is made at some call point, Alice is required to return a system in the unknown state at the corresponding response point. So there's an infinite possible ways in which you could set up your summoning task with different distributions of call and response points across space-time. Hayden and May were interested in characterizing the necessary and sufficient conditions under which there exists a protocol which guarantees a successful response to the task. So we've seen that in the specific setup on the previous slide, there doesn't exist a protocol guaranteeing a successful response to the task. But there are configurations of call and response points you can envision where Alice would be able to guarantee a successful response to the task. Most straightforwardly, if we have two call points and one lies in the future light cone of the other, then Alice can simply send the state to the first call point. If no call is made, she can just send it on to the second call point, and then she can always respond successfully to the task. So in order to characterize for which such tasks there exists a protocol guaranteeing success, Hayden and May used the following concepts. They referred to the causal diamond for some call response pair as the area in space-time lying in the future light cone of the call point, but the past light cone of the response point. They then said two causal diamonds are causally related if and only if there exists some causal path going from one point on one causal diamond to one point on the other causal diamond. They then provided this theorem, which nicely characterizes the set of necessary and sufficient conditions such that there exists a protocol guaranteeing a successful response. So this is possible if and only if, first, every response point lies in the future light cone of the start point, and second, every pair of causal diamonds, DI and DJ, are causally related. So, for example, here are some configurations here. One might consider. So this one on the left-hand side is not possible under the conditions of this theorem because none of those causal diamonds are causally related to each other. On the other hand, the other two are both possible because if you draw out the causal diamonds, you can see there exist causal paths linking all three causal diamonds in these cases. Interesting thing to note about this theorem is that these conditions are significantly looser than one might imagine in the circumstance where Alice has been given a classical object and required to return it under the same sort of conditions. So in that classical task, it would be possible for Alice to guarantee a successful response only if there existed a single continuous causal path through the causal diamonds, because she would have to take the classical object and send it on that causal path, passing through each of the causal diamonds in turn. That's not necessary in this case. So there are configurations of call response points such that Alice can complete this task successfully if what she's returning is a quantum state, but she can't complete it successfully if what she's returning is a classical object that has to follow a continuous causal path.
Classical information she could do.
Sorry.
It was classical information.
Yes, because that could be broadcasted everywhere, but a classical object that can only follow a single path. Yeah.
I'm trying to understand what the classical object is. It seems to me that a classical object can be cloned. Why couldn't I just make a perfect copy of this classical object and send it off? Yeah, sorry, I mean a classical object
that can't be duplicated.
That doesn't exist.
No, so I'm just setting this out as a thought experiment to... what I'm trying to get across is that the specialness in this case doesn't rest only on the non-clone ability of the quantum state. It's not just that it can't be duplicated. There are other quantum effects going on here. So in particular, what's going on is that quantum states can be delocalized across space-time. So effectively, the protocol that Hayden and May propose using here basically involves splitting the quantum state up into parts and using a quantum secret sharing protocol. The different parts of the quantum state can then be sent into different causal diamonds. And Alice will be able to respond successfully to the task, provided that whenever a call is made, she can get greater than half of the parts back to the relevant response point. So that allows her to complete the task without having to send the quantum state through down a continuous causal path through the causal diamonds.
Is there something surprising? I haven't fully internalized these conditions.
Yeah.
Is there something surprising there, or is it just what you'd expect given the non-clone?
I mean, this is surprising in that the conditions are looser than you would expect for just a classical object which can't be duplicated. No such thing exists, but suppose, you know, some object which can't be duplicated but has to follow a continuous path through space-time. This configuration in the middle, for example, you wouldn't be able to respond successfully to that task if you had to send your object on a continuous path through space-time. But you can respond here because if you can delocalize the state and spread it across space-time.
It's fair to say that this is not intuitive to the extent that particular fact about long error correcting codes are not intuitive. You share your information over various parties, you can cover it inversely.
Yeah, it's not obvious to the extent that if you're thinking about quantum states as being a bit like non-duplicatable classical objects, you're going to get the wrong answer here. So again, kind of the important thing to grasp to note here is that again, this result rests intrinsically on both relativistic and quantum results. So the relativity comes in the no signaling requirements, the quantum mechanics comes in the no cloning requirement, and also in the fact that you can delocalize quantum states in this way. So again, this is a result that depends intrinsically on both theories. Okay, so now I come to our new work. So we considered a new generalization of the summoning task. And to do that, we ask what seems like a very simple question, which is what happens if more than one call can be made? So now, of course, Alice can't be expected to respond to more than one call by producing the state at more than one response point. That would violate the no cloning theorem. So in our new generalization, we say that an arbitrary number of calls may be made, and Alice will be understood to have responded successfully to the task, provided that she returns the state at the response point corresponding to any one of the call points where a call has been made. So we have, therefore, a task which is closely related to the earlier task. It seems pretty similar in many ways, but it's not identical. To see that, we look at the new theorem that Adrian and I proved, which shows the necessary and sufficient conditions on the distribution of call and response points for summoning to be possible in this setup. So again, we have that every response point must lie in the future, like kind of the start point. But then we also have that for any subset of the call response pairs, there's at least one pair in that subset, such that the response point for that call response pair lies in the future, like kind of the call point of every pair in the subset. Sorry, that's very wordy. Clearer to see that by looking at some of these diagrams. You recall that this diagram in the middle was possible on the previous slide. On this slide, it's become impossible. So this configuration here, for this configuration here, it is possible for Alice to guarantee a successful response if she knows there will only be one call, but it's not possible for her to guarantee a successful response if there may be more than one call. So a lot of people have the intuition on hearing this that there's something very strange about that, because it kind of seems that if more than one call is being made, then we're just giving Alice more valid ways to respond to the task, and how can that possibly make things more difficult for her? So that's the reason for the name, the quantum paradox of choice. It's a reference to the paradox of choice in classical economics, which is the fact that giving consumers more choice sometimes makes them less happy. Here, giving Alice more choice makes things more difficult for her. So one can argue about whether or not it's actually a paradox, but it is a slightly strange, counterintuitive thing that occurs in the situation. So what actually is going on here? So the answer is really quite straightforward. Basically, in the single call summoning task, Alice has extra information about the distribution of events across space-time. So in particular, if she sees that a call has been made at some call point, she knows that no calls will be made anywhere else at any other call points, and she can use that information to help coordinate the behavior of her agents across space-time to help them respond successfully to the task. In this more unrestricted task, she doesn't have that extra information, and that makes it more difficult for her to coordinate how her agents behave and where they send bits of the quantum state. That makes it more difficult for her ultimately to respond successfully to the task.
Why does she not have that information?
So in this task, there's no longer a guarantee that only one call will be made. So if now in this version of the task, if she knows a call has been made at some call point, she doesn't therefore know that no other calls will be made.
Right, because she's at one particular location, so all she knows is that a call has or has not been made where she is.
Yes, so if she's in the future like kind of more than one call point, she'll know about what's happened at all of them, but if for an agent who's in the future like kind of only one call point, they won't know what's happened at the other call points. And so there's, yeah.
And so she still wins if she gets at least one call?
She wins if she responds correctly to at least one call, yeah.
So in what sense is this paradoxical? This is a harder... there's nothing easier for her.
I'm not saying it is a paradox. I'm saying that some people who we've described this to find it counterintuitive that giving Alice more ways to complete the task should make her job harder.
In what sense is there more ways to complete the task? Her role is to give one correct answer.
Her role is to provide the quantum state back at a response point which corresponds to a call point where a call has been made. So if I make more than one call, then she has two or more response points where she's allowed to return the state. So there's more valid ways in which she can respond correctly. Because she wins if she provides that state back at any of the response points corresponding to where a call has been made. So in the initial task, there will only ever be one response point which is a valid response. In this task, there may be more than one response point where she can respond validly.
Is it the case that... she's promised some bound of the number of call points, like there will always be at least this many call points called.
So Alice knows the distribution of call response points. She knows where all the call points and all the response points are. She just doesn't know where the calls are going to be made.
But she knows how many call points will be called.
No.
Because if she still has to deal with the possibility that it's only one call point,
yeah,
then there's no advantage. But if she's promised that... any two of the three call points will be called, and she just doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, so there's obviously no advantage because that's still a possibility. But some people find it weird that adding in additional call points makes the task strictly harder. Like some people think, well, it should be just as easy. It shouldn't become more difficult. It's clearly not a paradox. I've just explained why it's not a paradox. I'm just saying that some people do find it strange.
So that configuration in the middle, which is impossible, was previously possible.
That was previously possible, yeah. It's no longer possible.
It could only be, like, if it wasn't for the relativistic aspect, presumably it wouldn't happen like this.
I mean, so the...
I can't imagine a situation where you have to do task one or two, or task one. I mean, I can't imagine that happening more generally.
Sorry,
I can't imagine a situation where it gets harder and you have more ways of completing a task without this relativistic.
Yeah. So we have come up with tasks which have that property, which without the quantum component, we don't have any examples without the relativistic component.
Okay.
But you know, perhaps they exist and we just haven't thought of them. Yeah. So as I say, not everyone finds this surprising or counterintuitive, but a lot of people do. And I would suggest that one reason they do is because they're thinking about the initial Hayden May result kind of in the same way that Hayden May themselves do. So what they say about their result is, we have fully characterized which regions of space-time can hold all the same quantum information. We have provided a simple and complete description of where and when a qubit can be located in space-time. So they're kind of... A summary of their result is that they have the causal diamonds have some kind of ontological significance. They're regions of space-time which hold a certain amount of quantum information. And if that's how you're thinking about it, then it does seem a bit weird that making more calls can make the task more difficult for Alice, because if the causal diamonds contain the quantum information, in any case, Alice should certainly be able to respond successfully to the calls if the calls are made. On the other hand, our result suggests that the causal diamonds really have more of an epistemological significance. They're just regions of space-time in which Alice has information about which calls have been made. They're not regions in which the quantum state is localized in some sense. So I think that's a problem that arises from this way of using language to talk about quantum states as being in places in space-time or as being sent from place to place in space-time. And I would reinforce that that's by no means confined to this particular area of study. So here I've got a quote from quite a well-cited review on teleportation, which says something along the lines of, in teleportation, a quantum state is transferred from one place to another, not copied to the other place, but moved to that place. So it's the same kind of language of quantum states being in places and being transferred to places. And while that way of talking might sometimes be useful and might be a helpful way of operationally summarizing certain results, I think this is kind of a cautionary tale that it's also liable to lead us into errors of thinking. And that really, if we're speaking strictly, we shouldn't talk about quantum states as being in places. We should be talking about what operational things we can do with the quantum states at various space-time points. So that's kind of the interpretational take-home, I think, of this particular result.
Do you have an epistemological statement of this nature that is good for your result?
I would say that in the initial task, the causal diamonds are specially privileged in that they're not privileged ontologically, they're privileged in that they're regions of space-time where Alice has learned something about where a call has been made. And in our version of the task, Alice has less information about where a call has been made, and in particular, it doesn't follow from hearing that a call has been made that calls haven't been made elsewhere, and therefore the causal diamonds are less epistemologically privileged in that kind of circumstance. But the point is that they're not regions of space-time in which quantum states are somehow specially localized. They're just places where Alice knows things. So it's kind of a deflation of the language that we use to talk about this kind of result.
Connected to making things operationally defined, that the summing task itself, because there's no measurement that can verify that in a single shot the quantum state was summed, if I want to operationalize the summing task and actually subject somebody to the challenge of summing, you want me to imagine that the large ensemble of repetitions and measure psi. And if you're doing it poorly, then sometimes you're going to fail that
mission. Yeah, so in a call response configuration where there's a protocol guaranteeing a successful response, your measurement should always succeed, right? And if ever it fails, then we know that Alice is not doing something right. Modulo possible losses and so on. Whereas if there exists no protocol guaranteeing a successful response, eventually with sufficient repetitions, your measurement will gain a negative response. Okay, I'm going to move on to my second operational task. And so this is derived from a classical cryptographic task known as zero-knowledge proofing. The idea of a zero-knowledge proof is that some agent is supposed to prove something to some other agent without giving them any information other than that the fact is true. So in particular, a particularly important cryptographic application of this is to zero-knowledge proofing of knowledge, where what we want to prove is that we know something. Some agent, let's call her Alice, wants to prove to some agent Bob that she knows some fact, and she doesn't want to give Bob any information about the fact itself. She just wants to prove that she knows the fact. A protocol of that kind should have three properties. So it should be sound, meaning that if Alice doesn't actually know the fact, she shouldn't be able to prove that she does. It should be complete, meaning that if Alice does know the fact, she should be able to provide a correct proof. And then it should be zero knowledge, meaning that Bob gains no information other than that Alice knows this thing. So here I have an illustration which is taken from like a common toy example used to illustrate classically what zero knowledge proving should be. So the idea is that this is some kind of like special Aladdin's cave thing, which is blocked off at the back. And there exists a magic way of getting through this blockage at the back, but it only goes in one direction, so either A to B or B to A. And Alice knows how to activate this magic passageway through, and she wants to prove to Bob that she knows that, but she doesn't want to give him any information other than that she knows it. In particular, she doesn't want him to learn which direction it goes in. So the proof goes like this. Bob stays outside the cave while Alice goes inside. After a suitable period of time, Bob comes in and stands at the kind of branching point. He then flips a coin. If he gets heads, he calls out A. If he gets tails, he calls out B. Alice is then required to emerge from whichever passageway he's just called. Alice and Bob will then repeat this protocol as many times as needed to satisfy Bob that Alice doesn't need know the way through. So clearly, if Alice can repeatedly, can always emerge out of the correct passageway, Bob should eventually believe that she does indeed know how to get through that blockage. But also, Bob hasn't learned which direction she has to pass through in order to make that work. So Bob has gained no information other than that Alice knows this fact. So a quantum generalization of this task was proposed some years ago by the Horodecki family. So they considered the following scenario. Bob has in his possession a quantum system. It's in a state that he doesn't know. Alice, however, does know the state, and she wants to prove to him that she knows the state, but she doesn't want to give him any information about what the state is. So the question is there anything she can do to prove that? So the Horodeckis proved a no-go theorem to the effect that zero knowledge, completeness, and soundness are incompatible in this context. However, their theorem had some limitations. So first of all, they considered only the non-relativistic context. And that's important because we know that there are some cryptographic protocols which are impossible in a purely classical context and impossible in a purely quantum context, but which do become possible when one moves to the relativistic context. So in particular, there's one called bit commitment, which I'll discuss a bit later because it's going to be important in what follows. So that kind of example suggests that it's worth considering how these no-go theorems change when one does take these relativistic constraints into account. And the Horodeckis also assumed quite a limited form on what types of protocol you could consider. So in particular, they assumed that Bob would always keep the unknown system in his possession and ultimately perform some measurement on it. That's not the most general thing that one could do, and we'll see that, in fact, that in a more successful protocol, we have to do something different. Finally, they didn't allow relaxation of the security requirements. So they showed that perfect zero knowledge, perfect completeness, and perfect soundness can't all be achieved together. They didn't consider relaxing the security requirements a little to see how close one might be able to get to the optimal strategy. So in order to, in the hope of either overcoming the no-go theorem or strengthening it, Adrian and I defined a more general type of task, which we call knowledge concealing evidencing of knowledge of a quantum state. So this is defined as a protocol taking place in relativistic space-time in which Alice performs some set of actions to convince Bob that she knows the quantum state of some system. And ideally, he should learn as little as possible about the actual state during this protocol. So we define the security of this protocol by three parameters. The soundness parameter, epsilon s, is defined such that if Alice knows nothing at all about the state and the states are being drawn uniformly at random, then for any strategy that she may employ, the probability that she produces a successful proof on any given run is less than or equal to epsilon s. The completeness parameter, epsilon c, is defined such that if Alice does know the state and does perform the protocol correctly, then with probability at least 1 minus epsilon c, her proof should be accepted by Bob. And then finally, the knowledge concealing parameter, epsilon k, is defined such that if phi is Bob's best guess for the state after the end of the protocol, then the mod square fidelity between phi and the true state is less than or equal to epsilon k. So with these definitions in hand, we can state our new no-go theorems. I reinforce that to prove these no-go theorems, we don't make any assumptions about the form of the protocol. We consider the relativistic context, and we consider these possible relaxations. So first off, the first no-go theorem says there exists no non-trivial protocol for proving knowledge of a quantum state, which is perfectly zero knowledge. So where by non-trivial here, I mean simply that the probability that Alice produces a correct proof, if she does know the true state, should at least be greater than the probability that she doesn't, that she produces a correct proof if she doesn't know the true state. So that's a very minimal requirement, but it's obviously kind of the minimum thing you would have to require for the protocol to be considered to give any evidence of her knowledge of the state. And we can show that any protocol which has even this very minimal property must give Bob at least some information. And the proof of this basically goes proceeds from the idea that Bob always has the following strategy available to him. He can always take the system that he has in an unknown state and just put it aside. He can then replace it with a system prepared in a state that's known to him, and then he can then proceed with the protocol as usual. Now, if Alice still succeeds in producing a proof under those circumstances, Bob is justified in inferring that the state that he randomly chose to prepare is probably quite close in Hilbert space to the true state. So he's learned something he's learned something under those circumstances about the unknown state. He then also has the unknown state in his possession still, so he can carry on doing measurements and so on. So there's no possible way that we can have a protocol in which Bob gains no information at all through Alice's proof. So the second no-go theorem gives us a trade-off between completeness and soundness. And it says that in any protocol for proving knowledge of a quantum state of dimension D, we must have epsilon S over 1 minus epsilon C is greater than or equal to 1 over D. So let's consider, for example, what that means if D is 2 for a qubit. Suppose we have a protocol where Alice is always going to be able to provide a correct proof if she does indeed know the state. In that case, we have epsilon C equals 0. We then must have epsilon S is greater than or equal to 1 over D. So Alice will have probability at least half of providing a correct proof, even if she knows nothing at all. So that's clearly not a very good proof of knowledge. We see then that for quantum states of small dimension, it's not very easy to do anything to prove your knowledge of what their state is. I would also reinforce that nothing here is said about the zero knowledge property. Nothing here depends on the zero knowledge requirement at all. And so this no-go theorem applies to any kind of protocol one might attempt to use to prove one's knowledge of a quantum state, even if you don't care about giving away information in the course of that protocol. And your ability to give those proofs is limited by this bound 1 over D. On the other hand, of course, as D becomes large, the right-hand side goes to zero, and so that suggests that for quantum states of large dimension, it might be more possible to provide adequate proofs of one's knowledge of their state. Okay, so those were the negative results. Now to a positive result. So the Horodeckis suggested a few protocols that one might use to attempt something like zero knowledge proving. None of them were really any good at all. They either gave away a great deal of information or they allowed Alice to have a very high probability of succeeding without, even if she knew nothing at all. Adrian and I, however, have proposed this new protocol, which, while obviously still being constrained by the no-go theorems, comes much closer to being what one might think of as a satisfactory zero-knowledge proof. So the protocol goes like this. So Bob, having the quantum system, the unknown state in his possession, puts it aside and then prepares n systems and states chosen uniformly at random. He then labels all those states and the unknown state in system in some way and mixes them all in together and gives them to Alice. Alice's job then is essentially to identify which of these systems is the one that was initially prepared in that unknown state that she's supposed to know. Of course, Alice can't be expected to identify that state uniquely because there aren't quantum measurements which identify states uniquely. The best thing she can do is perform some kind of projective measurement projecting on the state in question. And if Bob has really prepared everything in states drawn uniformly at random, we would expect that she'll get about 1 over D times N positive results to her measurements there. So we need to allow Alice to select about that many possible systems in her answer to Bob. However, if she's giving multiple systems in her answer to Bob, Bob is going to gain a lot of information that way, because he will probably find that Alice's choices are somehow clustered about some region of Hilbert space, and that will tell him quite a lot about what state she was looking for. So that's going to be problematic. In order to get around that problem, we're going to use the protocol I alluded to previously, bit commitment. And so that's where the relativistic part comes into this protocol. So bit commitment is a protocol in which we have an agent, Alice, who makes a commitment at some time to the value of a bit, so either 0 or 1, and then unveils the commitment at some later time. The idea of the protocol is that Alice shouldn't be able to change her mind about her commitment after she's made it, but also no one should be able to find out what her commitment was until she has unveiled it. And it can be proven that this task can't be achieved with perfect security in a classical context. For a while, people hoped it might be possible to achieve with perfect security in a quantum context, but eventually no-go theorems were proved there too, showing that it also can't be achieved like that in the quantum context. But then it was then eventually shown that it is possible to achieve this task with perfect security in a relativistic context. So we're going to make use of that fact in this protocol. So the protocol will go as follows. Bob will hand over to Alice the set of n plus 1 states. Alice will do her measurements, and she will obtain some number of positive results. She will then be allowed to make bit commitments, committing her to the indices associated with some fixed number of the total systems. So hopefully Alice, the number of positive results Alice gets will be less than that number she's allowed to commit to. If it's greater than that number, she'll just have to choose some at random and hope she gets the right one. So she'll make those commitments. Bob will then tell Alice which index was the one associated with the system in question. If Alice did make a commitment to that index, she'll unveil it at that point. And if Alice successfully unveils the correct index, Bob will accept that Alice has made Alice did indeed know the true state.
Does she unveil the whole set or just the
one? No, she unveils only one. Yeah.
So it's not a standard bit commitment. She's committing a set of things and then unveiling just one of them.
Well, a bit commitment is supposed to have the property that you don't have to unveil it. So, Alice, there are some bit commitments where that's not the case. Some bit commitment protocols don't give Alice a choice about whether to unveil or not, but there are also good relativistic bit commitment protocols which do give Alice that choice. So we'll have to use one where she has the choice whether to unveil or not. Okay, so to a security analysis of this protocol. So first, an important point is I'm going to assume in this analysis that Kent's secure relativistic bit commitment protocol remains secure under parallel repetition. So there's a variety of relativistic bit commitment protocols out there. Adrian came up with some, then he and I came up with some more. None of them have been proved to be secure under parallel repetition. It's kind of hoped that they are, but we don't know that for sure, and for the purposes of this analysis, I'm just going to assume that they are. Under that assumption, Alice really can commit to only the number of indices she's supposed to be able to commit to. It then follows that if she really doesn't know anything about the state, the best thing she can do is just commit to some random set of indices. Obviously, then her probability of succeeding in the proof is just equal to the number of indices she's allowed to commit to over the total number of states she's been given. Suppose we choose that number to be equal to 1 over d. We know that's a reasonable sort of number in terms of the amount of positive results you'll probably be expected to get. It can then be shown that under those circumstances, epsilon c goes to 0 in the limit of large n. So that's because Alice can only fail under those circumstances. If she doesn't indeed know the state, she can only fail if the number of positive results she gets is greater than the number of commitments she's allowed to make. And then she also accidentally doesn't choose the right one to write index to go in her set of commitments. However, as n becomes very large, the probability of that happening becomes very small, and so in that limit, she's just effectively guaranteed to produce a correct proof. So that means we have epsilon s over 1 minus epsilon c equals 1 over d in that limit. So in the limit of large n, this protocol does indeed saturate the bound we saw earlier. So it's in that sense, in the limit of large n, this protocol is optimal for the soundness-completeness trade-off. It's also possible to show that Bob's information gain will go to 0 in the limit of large dimension d. So this protocol, assuming that the parallel composition assumption is correct, this protocol is basically more or less optimal both in all three parameters in the appropriate limits. Okay, before finishing, I want to point out particularly interesting interpretational point that kind of came up while we were working on this stuff. So there is a question there about what is the appropriate way to quantify knowledge for the knowledge-concealing parameter. So what we went with in the end was the fidelity squared between Bob's best possible guess after the protocol and the true state. That's a useful measure in many ways because we know that it has operational significance. It's known to be a good measure of Bob's ability to produce copies and predict outcomes. I mean, in many cryptographic contexts, Bob's ability to produce copies and predict outcomes is kind of what matters. So in that sense, we are quantifying the important thing here. However, the fidelity doesn't entirely capture everything that one might colloquially think of as being knowledge. So to see that, imagine a protocol which has the following property. Before the protocol, Bob knows nothing at all about the unknown state. And by the end of the protocol, Bob has learned for sure that the state is either plus X or minus X. Now, sort of colloquially, it seems like Bob has gained a lot of knowledge in the course of that protocol. Before the protocol, the number of possible states was infinite. Now it's just two. So Bob seems to have learned lots. However, the density matrix that arises from the uniform distribution over the whole of Hilbert space and from a half x plus half minus x is the same. So in that sense, the fidelity between Bob's best guess and the true state before and after this protocol will be exactly the same. So the fidelity squared way of quantifying knowledge will tell us that actually Bob has learned nothing in the course of this protocol. In some sense, that's the correct conclusion, because Bob's ability to, as I say, produce copies and predict outcomes will be the same before and after this protocol. But obviously, in another sense, if what we're interested in is kind of the classical description of Bob's knowledge, Bob has learned a great deal. So I think this is an interesting point just to reinforce that there are different ways of having knowledge about quantum systems. There's sort of classical knowledge, there's quantum knowledge. They're not the same thing. They won't necessarily lead to the same conclusions in these kind of situations. And so for example, for any practical situation where one wanted to have a zero knowledge proving protocol, one would have to consider carefully what type of knowledge is actually important in that particular context and decide whether the way of quantifying knowledge that we've used in these situations is the right one for that context. Yeah, so that's basically it for me. I would say that both of these tasks have practical significance in that they help characterize, for example, how we can send quantum states in a sort of distributed quantum computation task. So there's useful practical stuff there. But I think they also have interesting foundational payoffs in that they help kind of clarify our ideas about how we should think about quantum states as entities in space-time and how we should think about our relation to quantum states in terms of what we can operationally do with them.
In proving that, what do you set up protocols?
Sorry. To prove the no summoning results. Yep. So there's two parts to it. There's proving the necessity and there's proving the sufficiency. So to prove sufficiency, we do indeed provide a protocol which is guaranteed to succeed whenever the distribution over space time does satisfy those results. Yeah.
And what does that protocol look like?
So in the Hayden May one, it involves, as I said, quantum secret sharing. So the quantum state is kind of split up into many parts. Different parts are sent to different call points. After a call is or is not made, the agents there will either send the parts that they're in position with to their response point, or they'll send it to some other response point. And you can carefully arrange things so that no matter what happens, at least more than half of the parts always end up at the correct response point, and that means you can reconstruct the quantum state from those parts. For us, our version is actually simpler because if you look at our conditions, what it basically entails is that the causal diamonds can be placed in some sort of order. And so that means you can essentially just, not quite, but you can basically just send the quantum state on a more or less continuous path through the causal diamonds.
Your case doesn't include the... Isn't the Deutsch-Hayden example a special case of your case?
No, ours is a special case of theirs because ours is harder than this. So there exist configurations which are possible with them but not with us.
That's right, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Configurations are possible with them but not with you.
Yes, yeah.
Which, that must mean you must need their protocol for some of your examples.
No. We could use their protocol for any of our examples. But we can also use a simpler protocol because our conditions imply that the causal diamonds can be placed in an order, and therefore you can use a continuous causal path. But of course, the Hayden-May protocol would also work. It's just more complicated.
question of the inappropriateness of claiming that the quantum state relies on some region.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there's similar things that could be said even in classical examples. So, like, I always think of the Vernum cipher, where the ciphertext is the plain text summed with the key modulo 2.
Yeah.
And so if somebody asked, okay, here's the ciphertext and the key, where's the plain text? Is it right in the ciphertext? Mm-hmm. Is it in the key? It's sort of an inappropriate question. You need both to extract information about the plain text.
So yeah, exactly.
That my knowledge of the plain text, you know, requires access mm-hmm. to both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think nobody would.
In that case, talking about information as if it lies in a region of space is somehow fundamentally a category mistake.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and I think nobody would try and say that the plain text is in some place. Probably most people wouldn't. Whereas a lot of people do say that quantum information is in places. You know, Chris Timpson has a really nice article about this exact category error and how, you know, it doesn't make sense and it leads to errors of thought exactly like this.
So then what significance for the interpretation of the quantum state do you think that has? I mean, if you, like, for example, logic versus epistemic, or would you frame it some other way than that? What should I not believe the quantum state is in order to avoid these sorts of mistakes?
I mean, I don't think it implies anything for what one should believe about the quantum state. I think, first of all, one should just be very careful about how we talk about quantum states, and we shouldn't talk about them as if they are like classical substances which are in places and which travel through space-time like classical things. I think that if you take a psiontic view, you are more likely to talk about things in that way, which is not to say that all psiontic people do that, but I think usually those who do talk about quantum states being in places and being sent to places have a kind of psiontic picture in the back of their mind somewhere. So, I mean, it's not a proof. It's not a, you know, knockdown argument against that. It's just a warning about a mistake that you can be led to make if that's how you're thinking. I mean, I think it's certainly a proof against a kind of very strong form of Scientology, which demands that the quantum state should be kind of a persisting spatiotemporal entity, which follows some kind of continuous path through space-time that you can trace. And I don't think many people would actually argue that. Maybe they would, but that seems very implausible on the basis of many aspects of quantum mechanics. I don't think you can use this to argue that the quantum state is not ontic in some weaker sense than that. But I would note that, you know, sort of the colloquially, when we talk about things being ontic or being real, you know, physical, we often mean that they are spatiotemporally persisting entities. So the quantum state, it seems, is not real in that particular colloquial sense.
When you deal with relativistic quantum task, will you have trouble about related to infinities or singularities, or even related, or whether you need to do renormalization?
So this particular branch of relativistic quantum tasks is kind of the Adrian Kent approach, which is basically using big macroscopic constraints and tracing out the consequences of them. So we really use relativity here mostly only in order to impose the no signaling constraint. And so we're just basically seeing on quite a broad level what the consequences are of combining no signaling with various facts about quantum mechanics. There's also a slightly different field of relativistic quantum information which uses relativity in a more detailed way, which uses ideas from quantum field theory, which uses some stuff from general relativity, which kind of pursues consequences on a more sort of microscopic level. So here we're interested more in very broad operationally defined things. So normalization and infinities and stuff doesn't really arise because we're only looking in at the operational level.
When you were discussing defining quantum knowledge, an ignorance of plus x or minus x distinct from an unknown quantum state. I'm wondering if you could give sort of an example where, if you your state was plus or minus x in your ignorance, then you would have an advantage in any way.
Sorry, oh, we have an advantage anyway. If at the end of the state you're required to submit a classical guess as to what the task is, at what the state is, if you just know it's a distribution over all of Hilbert space, your probability of success is zero. If you know it's plus x or minus x, your probability of success is half. So yeah, in some classical sense, you've gained a lot of information. In a quantum sense or fidelity sense, you haven't gained any information.
So I think there's a paper by Samuel Pesky recently. It shows that some operational tasks can be better if you know that the distribution is plus or minus x.
I haven't seen.
So you need some knowledge about the source of the classical correlation space.
That would be very interesting. I'm not actually aware of any such results, but perhaps they exist. I did look briefly for them, but perhaps was not using the correct search terms or the correct theta terms.
On another note, so in the extended Wigner's friend experiment, the Wigner's friend is supposed to prove that they performed a measurement.
Yeah.
So it's kind of in spirit similar to what we have here. There's some kind of proof of some knowledge or like of, you know, performing some tasks. Do you think you could kind of map it on that kind of case or like?
So I mean, there's no zero knowledge requirement in the Wigner situation, but.
Well, there is a requirement, I think, that the Wigner cannot learn about the actual state of the system, at least not.
Oh, okay.
Well, maybe not explicitly, but that's kind of what I've kind of had in the back of my mind when I think about it.
I mean, yeah, I don't think that's imposed as a requirement, but I guess one might feel that there's a problem with the coherence of the situation if he does learn the exact state somehow. I would have to think about it more, but I would, off the top of my head, suspect that you have a similar kind of problem that you have with proving knowledge of a quantum state, that like soundness and completeness in some sense trade off against each other. You know, a proof needs to have those two properties of, you know, you must be able to give the proof if you have done it, and you must not be able to give the proof if you haven't done it. And I would suspect that you have that same kind of trade off arising.
Well, I think which is different there maybe, I guess, is that Wigner's friend, at least from the point of view of Wigner, is treated mechanically.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You're
yeah. So yeah. So, I mean, perhaps it would be interesting to see what happens if you try to write one of these agents as a quantum mechanical system. So here, the tasks are all defined operationally. So that's kind of outside the framework.
Any more questions? Right. Let's thank Emily again then.